Bernard Chu. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott, bringing you today's show from home. Today, the end of the Democratic Party as we know it. Today, analysis of the Democrats' defeat in the Georgia special election. Peter Dreyer, journalist, advocate, and professor of politics and chair of the Urban and Environmental Policy Department at Occidental College, breaks it down for us. And investigative journalist Arun Gupta joins us to discuss anti-Muslim terrorism. For our weekly Earth Watch, Chilean professor Felipe Gres Moreno on the recent international meeting of the International Union of Forest Research Organizations, where conflict broke out with some protesters accused of violence. He is with the Latin American Observatory of Environmental Conflicts. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. Senate Republican leaders today finally are revealing the draft of the health care law they've been crafting behind closed doors with no public hearings. Leaks of the draft show the bill would cut Medicaid and penalties for people not buying insurance and erase a raft of tax increases on the wealthy and corporations that helped to fund the Affordable Care Act. Democratic Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer denounced the process.
I've never seen a more radical or reckless legislative process in my time in politics. Write the bill in secret, discuss it in secret, send it to CBO in secret, and then rush it to the floor with no committee hearings, no amendments, and just 10 hours of debate for the minority. That's not how America ever got big things done.
The bill represents Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell's attempt to quell criticism by party moderates and conservatives and win the support he needs in a vote he hopes to stage next week before the July 4th recess. Facing uniform Democratic opposition, the Senate plan would fail if just three of the chamber's 52 Republicans defect. More than half a dozen Republican senators have expressed problems with the measure. Donald Trump was in Iowa for a campaign-style rally with his loyal supporters, the kind of event he relished before winning the White House. Trump was joined by billionaire Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross. Trump pointed to the wealth of Ross and Chief Economic Advisor Gary Cohn as qualifications for their positions.
We have the legendary Wall Street genius Wilbur Ross here. He's our Secretary of Commerce. We have Gary Cohn, who is the president of Goldman Sachs. Somebody said, why did you appoint a rich person to be in charge of the economy? I said, no, it's true. And Wilbur's a very rich person in charge of commerce. I said, because that's the kind of thinking we want. I love all people, rich or poor. But in those particular positions, I just don't want a poor person. Does that make sense?
Former prisoners say torture and abuse are rampant in a network of secret prisons in Yemen, run by the United Arab Emirates and allied Yemeni forces. Up to 2,000 people are estimated to have disappeared into at least 18 black sites over the past year. The AP found that U.S. interrogators have questioned some of the detainees and regularly receive access to their testimony, which experts say could violate international laws against complicity in torture. The torture includes a method known as the grill, in which the victim is tied to a spit like a roast and spun in a circle of fire. Several U.S. Defense Department officials speaking on condition of anonymity told AP that U.S. forces do participate in interrogation of detainees at locations in Yemen. They provide questions for others to ask and receive transcripts of interrogations from their Gulf allies. The self-styled Islamic State group has blown up a historic mosque in the Iraqi city of Mosul. The city's famed 12th century Al-Nuri Mosque with its iconic leaning minaret is known as Al-Hadba. It's the site from which the IS leader proclaimed the group's caliphate nearly 3 years ago. The explosion came as U.S.-led coalition forces and Iraqi troops close in on the last stronghold of IS in western Mosul's Old City neighborhood. A suicide car bombing outside a bank in Afghanistan's southern Helmand province killed at least 29 people and wounded dozens. Officials said most of those killed were civilians, although the dead also included soldiers and civil servants waiting to collect salaries ahead of the Eid al-Fitr holiday that marks the end of Ramadan. No one immediately claimed responsibility for the blast. A federal judge won't decide until later this year whether to order the shutdown of the disputed Dakota Access oil pipeline while federal officials conduct a more thorough environmental review. Federal Judge James Boasberg approved a schedule under which both sides in a lawsuit over the pipeline will submit written arguments on the matter in July and August. Boasberg ruled last week that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which prepared the environmental impact statement, did not adequately consider how an oil spill might affect the Standing Rock Sioux tribe. He ordered the agency to reconsider parts of its environmental analysis. Jan Hasselman is an attorney for the Standing Rock Sioux, which filed the lawsuit last summer that was later joined by three other Sioux tribes.
Our view is that until there is a proper risk analysis that looks at the risk of oil spills, that considers the impacts to the tribe, they shouldn't be operating that pipeline. And we'll be saying that as forcefully as we can to the court.
The tribe's suit says the $3.8 billion pipeline built by Texas-based Energy Transfer Partners threatens cultural sites and water supplies. The long-delayed project was finished earlier this year after Donald Trump took office and called for its completion. I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and today's show bringing you from home, still a little under the weather. We'll be back in studio tomorrow for our weekly roundtable, and we're going to start off today's show with our weekly Earth Watch, and we'll be talking about the campaign to stop GE trees. It is a global coalition of organizations and networks dedicated to protecting forests, biodiversity, and forest-dependent communities through the global rejection of all genetically engineered trees. It includes geneticists, foresters, ecologists, biologists, plant scientists, indigenous peoples, and other experts on the impacts of monoculture timber plantations. These experts have been working on the problem of GE trees and monoculture timber plantations for decades. Today, we'd like to welcome our Earth Watch guest, Felipe Grez Moreno. He has been a researcher since 2011 with the Latin American Observatory of Environmental Conflicts, which works to provide a complement to communities in situations of socio-environmental conflict. The organization has developed and supported diverse research methodology from the perspective of psychosocial impacts, environmental justice, and political ecology. They seek to contribute to various communities affected by the development and deepening of extractivism. Felipe, so tell us about this conference that you attended, where apparently you all participated in some protests and then were accused by the conference organizers of violence. First, tell us what the conference was all about, Felipe.
Yes, Margaret, I would like to start saying that we as OLCA, this local organization, is part of this international campaign to stop the genetically engineered trees, which is a global coalition of different organizations and networks, which is working about the transgenics and the genetically engineered trees around the world. This campaign is very concerned about this kind of conference, which is the EUFRO conference, a tree biotechnology conference, which it's been taking place in different countries. And this campaign also see the direct link between the country that has held this conference and the choice of the location to promote genetically engineered trees plantations. So this year, the Euroconference took place in Chile, specifically in the south of Chile, in the Concepción region, Biobío region, which is one of the most impacted regions of Chile related to the monoculture plantations. And we had to remember that in this January, Chile has one of the worst wildfires in its history. So we are very concerned about this kind of issue and this kind of conference because of the intent of the companies to promote the genetically engineered trees. And we think that the wildfire context, it's a very important pretext from the companies to make their business here in Chile.
Yeah, so Felipe, in other words, a lot of what the conference was about, or at least some of what it was about, was really justifying genetically engineered trees and forests,
yes.
From what I gather that you're saying. Give us some examples of how that happened within the conference. The International Union of Forest Research Organizations, you would think it's about protecting forests rather than promoting genetically engineered trees. Felipe.
Yeah, because, yeah, also the companies related to the monoculture plantations also use the word forest as if they were talking about plantations. That's one of the main struggles that people and organizations from local or from their own landscapes also defend, that these kind of things are plantations, are not forests. So the Chilean forestry industry took place in this event, in this conference, and also it has been supported by the government, the local government, and also the national government. And in this kind of conference, lots of researchers around the world came to Chile, and they listened to the activities from the companies and also from the local government. But no community were invited to this kind of conference. And they were talking about
Felipe,
the allocation.
Let me again underscore that what they are calling a forest, and you're calling a plantation, really is about growing a monoculture trees, right? Planting trees for monoculture and then turning around and calling it a forest. A forest being quite different, a forest being natural and not only made up of one tree, you know, of one type of tree. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay, carry on.
Some kind of organization, international, we're trying to press different authorities, because it's a definition adopted by government, by the companies, and we think that it's a way to undercover what they are trying to do in the landscape, which is plant lots of monocultures, which came with lots of impact in the environmental and also social impact.
So why monoculture trees? I mean, why is there this really global interest, especially on the part of multinational corporations and others, to plant these monoculture plantations? What are they used for, Felipe?
They are using for producing paper, cellulose. They are in sense of doing some biofuel, specifically private business. And there are companies who intend to grow these kind of trees to make directly money from them.
Right. And tell us about the impact that is already happening in Chile. You're based in Chile, of the indigenous people and rural communities of these monoculture plantations, Felipe.
I think that the main impact is that in this last 40 years, when these monoculture plantations became legal in Chile under the dictatorship of Pinochet, Chile has lost like 3 million of hectares. It's been replaced by monoculture. That produced lots of migration, contamination, loss they lost the soils, and of course the native forests disappear everywhere.
Yeah, and so what happened? I mean, some protesters were there and throughout this conference to clearly draw out what to me sounds like a level of hypocrisy going on, of trying to pass this stuff off as environmentally friendly and as protecting the forests, et cetera. So why were some of the protesters accused of violence? What is that about? What happened?
With some local organizations, we prepare different activities parallel to this EU4 conference in Concepcion, which are very different activities. We protest in the streets. We came to do a sort of strike in the front of the inauguration of this conference. And one of these activities was to be at the University of Concepcion, specifically in the biotechnology center of the university, which was one of the main sponsors of this conference. And we came here to protest against both the university and the presence of these international delegations of researchers. And we came and we reunite in the front of this center. And when the people who is in charge of the delegation noticed that we were there, they decide to change the schedule of the conference, and they didn't go to this center, and they came to a tour by the city. So we were there in this biotechnology center of the university, and we do a manifestation at the outside with some signs, with typical protests. And, there were some sort of graffiti made in the entrance of the center. But then the center came and do a public statement telling that these eco-terrorists came and do some violent acts.
They're claiming then that because of there was graffiti, that the protesters were violent. I mean, just really ridiculous in my view.
Yeah.
But we are out of time, Felipe Iglesias Moreno. And for people who want to find out more about your work, what should they do? Is there anything they can do to get more information?
They can look us in the social networks. We are a Chilean organization. As I told you, we are part of this campaign, the Stop GE Trees campaign. You can find us on Facebook as Olca, and also Twitter, write an email, something like that.
Right. Okay. And Olca is OLCA, all in capitals. And of course, you could also go to the Global Justice Ecology Project website.
Yeah.
We are our partners for our weekly Earth Watch and get information there. Well, good luck and all the best to you, Felipe Iglesias Moreno. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah. One last thing I want to
tell
you about this statement of violence. We, as the international campaign, we think that one can by no means compare the violence perpetrated by the timber industry, including all the impacts that we talk about, like land theft, the wildfires, the despoiling of freshwater source, also the contamination, the chemical exposures, or the militarization of the indigenous communities, and the destruction of the biodiversity. You can now compare with graffiti denouncing that kind of violence. So it's also a new way of doing violence by this timber company.
Right. Well, thank you so very much for joining us. Thank you for that. And we've been following
so
the campaign to stop GE trees, so our listeners will be hearing a lot more about this. Felipe, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, hopefully in USA you can also stop the liberation of the GE trees because they are discussing right now this kind of issue.
Okay, very, very good. Thank you so much. Thank you, Felipe. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and we are now going to turn our attention to what the heck happened in Georgia. Are we seeing the end of the Democratic Party as we know it after the Democratic Party's devastating defeat in the 2016 presidential election? Major tests of the party's resilience took place this past Tuesday, where two special congressional elections were held in Georgia's 6th district and South Carolina's 5th district, both considered conservative Republican strongholds. Georgia's 6th seat, for example, was long held by Newt Gingrich and then by Tom Price, Trump's current Health and Human Services Secretary. The race for Price's empty seat drew national attention and was seen as a referendum of sorts on Trump and the GOP, with John Ossoff, the Democratic candidate, young man, 30 years old, as a face of the opposition. Ossoff drew the most votes in the first round of the race, and handily, with 48% of the vote, just a few thousand votes away from winning the seat outright. Going into Tuesday's two-person runoff, Ossoff's competition was Georgia's Secretary of State, Republican Karen Handel. The pressure built up around this race made it the most expensive House election, we are told, of all time, racking up to a near $55 million spent from both of the candidates and from outside groups and super PACs. The Democratic Party funneled its resources into Ossoff's campaign. But on Tuesday night, the Republican won. Karen Handel won, and the Democrats lost. How did this happen? What same blind spots do Democrats have now that they also had last November? How does race play into it? What needs to change for a progressive to succeed? And to break this down for us, we are delighted to welcome to the program Peter Dreyer, Professor of Politics and Chair of the Urban and Environmental Policy Department at Occidental College. He's also a journalist and advocate. His latest article, Why Did Democrats Ossoff and Parnell Lose Their Congressional Races in Georgia and South Carolina, is up on the Huffington Post website now. So, Peter Dreyer, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Margaret. Good to be here.
Okay, Peter, what we're going to do is we're just going to play a short clip on the Ossoff loss to hear what mainstream media is saying is dealing with this. And this clip is from CBS News.
This is not the outcome any of us were hoping for.
For Democrats, it was $32 million down the drain. Newcomer John Ossoff lost to Republican Karen Handel by 4 points.
Special thanks to the President of the United States of America.
The President's special advisor, Kellyanne Conway, issued her thanks to everyone who breathlessly and snarkily proclaimed the race as a referendum on POTUS. You were right. Ohio Democrat Tim Ryan says it shows his party's brand is toxic.
You know, we better take a good, long, strong look in the mirror and realize that the problem is us. It's the party.
We need a genuinely new message, wrote Seth Moulton of Massachusetts, a serious jobs plan that reaches all Americans. The party had hoped to capitalize on President Trump's historically low approval ratings. But Democrats have now lost all four special elections to fill seats vacated by Trump appointees. The House Democratic campaign operation tried to console the troops in a memo, insisting the party has enough momentum to flip control of the House in 2018. And party leaders warned against reading too much into last night's results, since Georgia's 6th district hasn't gone blue in 39 years.
We actually came closer than ever.
We still lost, though.
Well, of course. But, you know, in a normal year, we wouldn't even have any shot.
Some Democrats noted today that the party only sank big cash into this risky race because the party's base was so fired up about it. But other Democrats argued that that just shows that the party needs to embrace a more progressive agenda, Anthony, because that's where all the energy is right now.
All righty, so there you go. And Professor Peter Dreyer, you heard their analysis of what happened. We know that there are a lot of factors involved, and let's, for now, just focus on the Georgia race, where there was a lot of hope on the part of progressives on John Ossoff, a kind of a new face of the Democratic Party. We know it's complicated, but perhaps not so. What do you think was the major factor in his loss? If there is one, if you think there is a major factor.
Well, there's a couple of things here. I mean, you said earlier in your opening remarks, is this the end of the Democratic Party? And in some ways, I think what happened on Tuesday in Georgia and also in South Carolina is in some ways a sign of the rebirth of the Democratic Party.
Okay.
But there are some lessons to be learned from why John Ossoff lost on Tuesday and why Archie Parnell, his counterpart in South Carolina, lost. Both of these seats were extremely Republican safe seats. Last November, Tom Price won a landslide victory in his in this Georgia congressional district in the suburbs of Atlanta. Nobody last November or even in January thought that a Democrat would have any chance whatsoever of winning this seat. And then this newcomer, this new face, John Ossoff, shows up. He says, "I'm running." And hundreds of volunteers showed up to help him in his campaign. And I talked to some people down there. They put house signs on their lawns. People didn't know that their next-door neighbors were Democrats or liberals. It sort of, it was like a coming-out party for liberals and progressives in that district. And he almost won. He got 48% of the vote. And his opponent, his Republican opponent, ran a very dirty campaign the last day or two. Before the election, she ran an ad, or her independent allies ran an ad, basically accusing Ossoff and Bernie Sanders, who had endorsed him, of being partly responsible for the killings of the shootings of the Republican baseball team in Virginia last week. I mean, just outrageous. So he came pretty close. And what I looked at pretty carefully in both the Georgia race and the South Carolina race was the margin of defeat was that neither of these Democratic candidates did enough to or focused early enough to get the African American vote out. The African American vote was about 13% of all potential voters in the Georgia race, and he didn't really reach out to the black community very aggressively during the primary, where he won 48% of the vote, and then he didn't. He waited till almost the last, two or three weeks to really put on a very aggressive campaign around getting African American voters. If he had done a better job of reaching out to African American voters, he probably would have won. This is the same lesson the Democrats should have learned last November when Hillary Clinton lost, narrowly lost the three states. Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, that turned the Electoral College over to Donald Trump. She lost those three states by a combination of 77,000 votes, and if she had been able to mobilize the black vote to the same extent that Barack Obama had done 4 years earlier, she would have won those three states, and she would have been president of the United States right now, and we'd all be protesting against some of her more moderate corporate views, but we'd also be not in the situation we're in right now with a semi-fascist like Donald Trump. So, it's heartbreaking to lose. A couple of days before the election, the polls showed that Ossoff was ahead in the polls, and so it's disappointing. But this is really a sign of the resistance against Donald Trump, and I think it bodes pretty well for November 2018, where the swing House districts, there are about 70 or so swing House districts that the Republicans now control, that the Democrats have now said, we can win these districts. All they need to do is win 24 of them and hold on to the ones they have now. And they take over the House in November of 18. And when they take office the following January, they can impeach Donald Trump. They can investigate his tax returns. They can investigate his Russia connections. They can stop anything that he's doing in terms of legislation. So I'm pretty optimistic about the possibility of mostly liberal and progressive Democrats winning seats in these swing districts, which are not as conservative as the Georgia district or the South Carolina district, where the Democrats almost won but lost.
Yeah, well, Peter Dry, I'm glad for that hopeful view there. However, I'll tell you what a number of us, particularly in the black community, are worried about. It seems as though there is a blind spot when it comes to black voters, even on the part of progressive candidates. I mean, even in Bernie's campaign, there were a lot of complaints, and there actually still are, about how much attention is being paid to the black community and also black and brown communities, actually, and the whole racial divide in the country, and that if candidates are not speaking directly to the issues of concern within our communities, it's very hard then to motivate people to come out and vote. I mean, you could say, well, come out and vote because it is a vote against Trump, but people are increasingly feeling a bit fed up of like, well, what really are the Democrats doing for us? I mean, I was quite struck that even in the so-named liberal media, mainstream as well as alternative, when I went through it this morning, there was practically nothing about the verdict that happened in Milwaukee yesterday about the police officer being let off, basically, for the killing of a black man. Also, the previous shoot decision that happened earlier in the week. And then the story of the 17-year-old Muslim girl who was killed had completely dropped off of the media. So it seems to me as though people think, well, we can just take these communities for granted, that we don't really have to make views, strong views, on these issues of concern, of police abuse, of mass incarceration, of the rise of the anti-Muslim racism, and what feels to a number of us in the black community to be open season on young black people, but nevertheless they trot out close to an election to come out and expect black people to turn out in numbers as they did for Barack Obama, and that ain't going to happen unless something really changes in the focus of the Democratic Party. And the fight going on now between more of the Blue Dog Democrats going after Pelosi's leadership and blaming her leadership for what happened on the, I guess, the right within the Democratic Party, and then the left of the Democratic Party saying, well, you need to show a more progressive agenda. But does that progressive agenda then include the kinds of issues that would draw the attention of the black community and feel that we're being represented? Peter Dreyer.
I don't disagree with you, Margaret. I think that both John Ossoff in Georgia and Archie Parnell in South Carolina did take the African-American vote for granted, and the result was they lost. And so that's a lesson to be learned, just like I said
With
Hillary Clinton. Now, you know, so there's two issues here that you identified. One is having a policy agenda and rhetoric that addresses the problems and points the finger at America's racism by banks, by landlords, by cops, by the criminal justice system, and proposes fixes for those. And that's important, and I think that's one of the lessons of this race. The Democratic Party definitely has a progressive wing, or reflected by people like Sherrod Brown, Senator Brown from Ohio, and Elizabeth Warren, and Bernie Sanders, and Karen Bass, our congresswoman here from California, from Los Angeles, and people like that. And then it has a corporate wing, which is more Wall Street oriented and so forth. And there's a battle going on inside the Democratic Party. But in general, if you looked at the Democratic Party platform that Hillary Clinton ran on, although she wasn't very charismatic and she wasn't very effective at espousing it, it's, you know, raising the minimum wage, a jobs program. She had actually a fairly substantial set of policy ideas for addressing the problems of police racism and the racism of the criminal justice system. And, of course, Trump is doing absolutely the opposite of that. He and Sessions have said they're not going to investigate racism by local police departments. So I think that what you just said is exactly the lesson the Republicans have to learn, the Democrats have to learn. But there's another part of that, and that has to do with you can't just parachute organizers into congressional districts or Senate districts or states during presidential elections a month or two before an election and try to get young people and people of color and low-income people excited about a campaign. You've got to be there all year round doing community organizing, doing labor organizing, building a base. The Republicans have been doing this for over a decade. The Koch brothers and the other right-wing billionaires have invested hundreds of millions, billions of dollars into building a grassroots base all in the key states where they think they can contest for power. And they don't look at it as a short-term fix. They look at it as building a movement. And the Democratic Party and the environmental movement, the labor movement, the women's movement, Planned Parenthood, the civil rights organizations, the gay rights organizations, they need to come together. And this is what I say in my article in the Huffington Post today. They need to come together and invest in community organizing in between elections so that when it's time to elect a liberal, progressive Democrat in these swing districts all over the country and the swing states, and then in 2020 running somebody for president, those people aren't saying, oh, now you show up when you need my vote. They've got to be there. They've got to have groups like we have in Los Angeles, like Lane and the Community Coalition and other groups like that, that are on the ground every day mobilizing people. And if people are in touch with these issues of injustice, of racism by the cops and by the banks, the fighting for the local minimum wage, fighting for environmental justice, fighting for a jobs program, fighting for affordable housing and tenants' rights, if people are engaged in that kind of activism on a regular basis in between elections, then when the Democrats show up and knock on their doors during election time, they'll say, oh, yeah, you've been here all the time, and now I understand why I need to come out to vote. And that's the solution. It's not simply espousing a set of policy ideas. You got to be there mobilizing people all year round. And I would estimate that the Democrats and their allies and the progressive rich people that donate to the party, as well as the everyday people, John Ossoff mostly got his money from small donations. Those people have to start investing in, you know, thousands of organizers all over the country. And it's completely doable. It's completely doable. After Trump got elected, the ACLU got $50 million in additional contributions in a couple of months. So the money is out there for reaching out to the communities of color and poor people to do the kind of organizing that would have ensured that Ossoff would have won on Tuesday, that Archie Parnell would have won in South Carolina on Tuesday, and that somebody like Elizabeth Warren or somebody like that will win the presidency in 2020. But right now, I think, like I said earlier, I'm very optimistic, given Trump's incredible low popularity, that the resistance to Trump will translate into a Democratic victory, majority victory in the House. And at that point, Trump is neutralized. Trump can't get anything done. He won't get anybody to vote for him. I think that's what we should be looking for. And I think these elections on Tuesday actually portend pretty well the incredible shift in the voting population. Even though they lost, there was a huge shift towards the Democrats in the most conservative districts that were much more conservative than most of the other House districts, including, by the way, 9 swing districts in California. We can get rid of Daryl Issa in San Diego, for example, in November, and he's really worried, and that's true all over the country.
Well, Peter Dreyer, just in wrapping up here and getting back to the issue of the black vote and neglecting a certain negligence of the black community, I mean, you also in your article, which I thought was really quite good, and I would encourage all of our listeners to go to the Huffington Post and read Peter Dreyer's article. We also posted it on the Sojourner Truth Facebook page, because you also talked about the impact of voter suppression and also the gerrymandering and the impact impact of voter suppression in a place like Wisconsin, for example, where if were it not for voter suppression, Hillary likely would have taken Wisconsin. That would have made a difference. But also to say that throughout the Democratic Party, including the Bernie wing, the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, I don't think, and a number of people that I've talked to who work on the grassroots level, that enough attention is paid to the most impoverished in our communities. I mean, an example was the People's Summit that happened recently in Chicago. Over 3,000 people. I was supposed to be there, but I took ill at the last minute. We could not get poverty included in the agenda, right, to be highlighted as one of the issues that the people's agenda should focus on, and ending poverty. And Congresswoman Gwen Moore from the Congressional Black Caucus did the rare thing of showing up at the People's Summit. No space was made for her. I thought she was really disrespected. They didn't even bother to introduce that she was there. And she's the only one in Congress that has a piece of legislation, the Rise Out of Poverty Act, that attacks Clinton's welfare reform. Now, we can't expect Black people to take kindly to that from Bernie's folks or from anybody else within the Democratic Party. So I agree with your analysis, and I really think they have to look at that and go beyond the usual NGO suspects in the Black community and really get down to what my cousin Martha from SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, says, go to the people who suffer the most. And the Democratic Party, including the liberal wing, hasn't gotten there yet. And once they get there, I think that they will get some kind of response from Black and brown people. I think you would agree with that, Peter Dreyer. But we appreciate your work, and we are going to have to go on now to talk about anti-Muslim terrorism. But we'll have you back, I hope, because I also want to get your views on health care and what is happening now with what is going to be unveiled by the GOP.
Anytime you want me, I'm available, Margaret. It's always a pleasure to be on your show, and I admire your passion, and I hope your listeners recognize that you're a force to be reckoned with in our community, and I'm glad to know that your voice is being heard, because that's how we're going to get change, is when people, you know, talk about these things and don't put them under the rug. So thank you.
Okay, thank you, Peter Dreyer. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We are late now with our station break, and coming up, Arun Gupta is awaiting to join us to discuss anti-Muslim terrorism. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Where have all the flowers gone? Long time passing. Where have all the flowers gone? Long time ago. Where have all the flowers gone? The girls have picked them, everyone. Oh, when will you ever learn? Oh, when will you ever learn?
All righty. And where have all the flowers gone? When will they ever learn? A lesson that we have to ask, I suppose, to the Democratic Party and all of the mainstream parties. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And we'd like to welcome our SoundCloud listeners. You can check us out on SoundCloud and just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And you can check us out on our website at www.sotrueradio.org. And if you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. And today we'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the state of Maryland. We would now like to go on to the tragedy, really, the terror happening now in Muslim communities across the nation. Trump is quick to blame Muslim for terrorist actions. He called the 2015 San Bernardino mass shooting another Islamic disaster. And after last year's Pulse nightclub shooting, he tweeted that he appreciated the congrats for being right on radical Islamic terrorism. But a massive threat, one that gets very little attention from Trump and mainstream media alike, is that of anti-Muslim terrorism and hate crimes coming from the right wing. And just this past Sunday, Nabra Hassanin, 17-year-old Muslim girl, murdered in Virginia, and police outrageously now calling it a road rage incident. I happen to think it's a hate crime, but I'd like to now welcome Arun Gupta, investigative reporter. His work has been published in Washington Post, The Nation, The Guardian, and others, and he has been writing about right-wing and anti-Islamic extremism. Arun, thank you for joining us.
Hi.
Hey, Arun. Thank you so much for joining us. So, Arun, putting together what happened with NABRA, the killings that happened in London, and much more, just, you know, give us your views on what you think is happening, and also the response or lack of response from Trump and his administration. Arun Gupta.
Well, clearly this is a post-9/11 phenomenon. You know, the roots of racism run deep in terms of anti-Arab, anti-Muslim racism. You know, we can see it even within Hollywood in the 1990s, the kind of the terrorist Muslim starts to replace the, you know, the Russian communists as the bad guy in films. But it really shifts after 9/11 with the rise of Islamophobia in the wakes of the attacks that, of course, were basically blowback for U.S. policy. But with George Bush as president, that at the time presented a dilemma for the right because he needed the support of Middle Eastern states. So there wasn't this kind of overt official support for Islamophobia. Then with Barack Obama's election, we see the Islamophobia start to really just ratchet up significantly and enter the mainstream. And of course, now with Trump, it's entered the White House itself, you know, in terms of both rhetoric and policies. Like the Muslim ban. And one report that I just did, I did a couple of reports, one in The Intercept about how militiamen are apparently cooperating with federal police in some instances with the support of federal police agents, such as Department for Homeland Security. But another report in The Raw Story about this anti-Sharia event that went on recently, these protests around the country. I went to one of the events in Seattle, and I interviewed all these people who came out in support. And there is where I really saw this radicalization process of the white supremacist Islamophobic right. You know, we hear a lot about radicalization, quote unquote, of Muslims, Muslim youth. But there is this radicalization process going on among white supremacists in this country, white men who are armed and dangerous. Basically, they feed off this hatred of Muslims. They see Muslims as this both external but internal threat. I was asking these various folks, you know, from all sorts of different, like, tiny organizations, fascist organizations, white supremacists, militia organizations, you know, did they see that there is this threat of Sharia? And they're, like, claiming, oh, yeah, there's this threat. And I would be like, well, where does it exist? And they would be like, well, it's in this town in Texas or Michigan or Montana. And I would explain, you know, Sharia law does not actually exist anywhere in the United States at all. But they are convinced this is some sort of existential threat to American society. And then from there, this spills over into actual violence. Just a month ago, there is this individual, Jeremy Christian, who was verbally bashing two young women of color, a black woman and one wearing a hijab on a train in Portland. Two men came to their aid, actually three men. He killed, allegedly killed two of them and stabbed a third in the neck who barely survived. And he had been filmed just a month earlier at an alt-right rally throwing Nazi salutes and yelling, "Die Muslims." And this alt-right rally was put on by this guy called Joey Gibson, who is this extremist activist from Vancouver, Washington, who was involved in this anti-Sharia march in Seattle that I went to. I saw him there. So we see how all these pieces fit together. And then, you know, we get this case like Nabir Hussein. We get the attack in the London mosque. You know, there was the attack right after the election where a man shot two Indian men and killing one in a bar in Kansas because he thought they were Muslims. Right before the election, there was a militia in Kansas that wanted to wipe out a whole Somali community, calling them cockroaches. You know, so there is this really ugly current of Islamophobia that is bubbling up in Western countries, not just the United States.
Yeah, and Arun, you know, the young man that's being held in the murder of the young 17-year-old is said to be an immigrant from El Salvador. We also saw that certainly in Wisconsin, the police officer that was just let off for the shooting of an unarmed black man, and also some of the police officers in Baltimore in the killing of Freddie Gray, were black. So it seems as though racism and also Islamophobia can cross color lines. And, you know, that's why this, you know, whole phenomena that you're talking about and the use even and embedding in the psyche of American people about Islamic terrorism is absolutely so dangerous. Just some final comments from you, Arun Gupta.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, because this isn't just Islamophobia. It's also the alt-right is really the thing that's interesting about them. All these little subcultures, they don't really like each other that much. They are joined by support of Trump, by Islamophobia, but also this very deep-seated misogyny. Everyone defined Sharia. Of course, they don't really know what Sharia is. Sharia is more of a moral and ethical code, and it informs what is known as Islamic law. You know, Sharia law is a bit of a misnomer, but they would define it all in terms of women. So, you know, we have to stop honor killings, that child marriage, you know, pedophilia, female genital mutilation. Latter, of course, is not really an Islamic practice. It's more of a regional practice across Central Africa that's found nearly as much in Christian communities there as it is in the Islamic communities. And it's not really found in the Middle East at all. But the point being that they are deeply united by this hatred of women. And, you know, I think so the case in Virginia with Nabir Hussein, and also in Portland, you know, that attack began where he was bashing these women. And there is very much misogyny. And that, of course, is part of what really propelled Trump to power. And it does unite men. You know, one of the things that people have to confront, these rallies are so far tiny. And what I say to people is like, look, they're small, but they're dangerous. The real danger is a state. But interestingly, in Seattle, I would say 15 to 20% of the attendees, it was overwhelmingly men, were men of color, you know,
white supremacy
does cross the race line.
Yeah, absolutely. That's good to know. We're out of time, Arun, but please come back to us soon so we can continue this discussion. Thank you for your work, and we encourage people to go look for your articles, one of which is in the Intercept, and learn more about your work. Thank you, Arun Gupta.
Thank you, Margaret.
Okay. We are out of time. I'd like to thank all of today's guests. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. Special thanks to assistant producer Stephanie Case, who's been terrific during this time that I have been ill and helping to hold the show down. Also, our engineer, Mr. T. Teddy Robinson, and all who helped to make this show possible, our intern, Sherelle Withers. Tomorrow is our weekly roundtable. You won't want to miss that. I'll be back in studio for that. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.